Okay, well, thank you. I'll sort of, this in some ways can be viewed as a continuation of what went on yesterday, and a couple of the points I made yesterday or didn't get a chance to finish making will pop up again. This time I'm using overhead, so I look more like a physicist than before. It just depends on whether one has slides around or not. Okay, so as I told a few of you, many of the ideas that I'll be presenting to you, we actually, after beating them around for several years, put together into a long article in Cell, which came out in the January 26 issue. So, and I've given a couple of people copies, and if you like, I can give Terry a copy for the Institute files, or if that would be helpful. And so that will make it easier to follow, and maybe some of the more detailed subtleties are brought out there too. It's a fairly long thing, but maybe you'll have plenty long enough out of this. Anyway, what I want to talk about is thinking about helicase mechanisms again, and sort of trying to see whether what we and others know about other systems can all be put together to make sort of a unified model of helicase function at a very gross level. Obviously, it's perfectly clear that each helicase does some subtleties to deal with structural subtleties to deal with the detailed issues, and so you can't have a unified field theory that actually says all helicases work like this. That would be very presumptuous and clearly wrong. On the other hand, the general principles that I'll talk about, I think, do fit put together very well and integrate helicases with other machines from which they may have evolved or with which they may be connected in some way. This just tells you a little bit about where I'm going to be going. I'll talk a little about helicase definitions, mechanisms, and the issue of coupling, which means that helicases are not of any interest biologically by themselves. So they just, in fact, a nice clean helicase goes through a piece of DNA, comes out the other side, and nothing's happened. So obviously the reason for a helicase is to transfer the genetic information on one strand by ending up bound to another one, or by end up bound to a protein, or by something else, and I'll talk about that. But that's what I mean by coupling in this sense, although I sometimes tend to use the word for more things than one, but I'll try to avoid that. Then I'll talk about nested reaction cycles, by which I mean, first of all, the whole helicase chugging through an entire piece of DNA, and then the step that involves the then look at it from a coupling perspective, then look at it from a point of view of what one ATP can accomplish, then look at it from the point of view of breathing of the end of the helix and how you and whether you can actually view that as the way that helicases move and so forth. Then I'll talk about cytoplasmic motor proteins briefly, because that's basically a helicase which moves along a track in a very similar way, and we understand quite a lot about that now from the work of many other people. And we can sort of, but it doesn't have to open the track, so that's sort of, and it's driven by ATP, so that's sort of half the battle. The other half of the battle is that we know a lot about single-stranded DNA binding proteins and models, and those things move through DNA or do or don't, depending on the thermodynamics and kinetics of the reactions, but this has nothing to do with ATP hydrolysis. So you might say that putting these two things together makes you into a helicase in some way, and so that's the sort of the way I've been looking at it. Then I'll give you some examples of, and I'll briefly recapitulate what I said about the transcription elongation complex, because that's actually in principle a very simple helicase interaction about which we know a lot, and we can look at it both as a coupled thing that's moving forward without any problem, and a decoupled thing that's actually engaging in a random walk and sliding back and forth on an isopotential surface, as I tried to tell you yesterday. Then I'll use an example of the Rho protein that our lab has worked a lot on, which is a transcription termination helicase, which separates the DNA-RNA hybrid within the transcription elongation complex. And this has the advantage that you can separate loading, translocation, and opening from one another in this system, because it loads on far away from where it has to actually separate the base pairs. It gets there by chugging along the one of the tracks, the one that to which it's actively bound, and then it opens the DNA, and it separates the DNA-RNA hybrid, and we can look at those things separately in model systems that Katie Wallstrom in our lab in particular developed beautifully. And then I'll say a few words about the whole issue of helicases in general, relationships between propulsivity, coupling efficiency, apparent step size, and ATPase reaction cycle, and then see to how far you can get toward an integrated model. I'm sorry that list looks so long, but I hope it won't inhibit anybody from asking questions like you did yesterday, because I thought that was a lot of fun, and I'd like to continue in that vein. So again, you know, if we don't get all the way through everything, it's not a tragedy in any sense. Ask questions whenever you want. Okay, so the helicases are generally components of macromolecular machines, and I think that in fact, you know, when you study a helicase separately, it's like studying the, you know, the left front wheel of a car without taking account of the fact that it has a role to play in the whole function of the car. Yes. What is a helicase? Okay, actually, I'll be defining it in a minute. But a helicase is something that is a protein, which is usually an oligomer, very often a hexamer, of identical subunits, which has on each subunit a binding site for single-stranded DNA or RNA, and it's specific for one or the other, not in terms of sequence, but in terms of just what DNA or RNA, it can discriminate between the backbone essentially and the sugar, and then it also has a binding site for ATP, which drives a conformational change at every step. So it's an ATP driven motor that moves along double-stranded DNA or whatever or any double-stranded thing, separates one strand from the other, requires ATP to do that. And then comes out the other side. I'll give a real definition in a minute, but that's what it is.
What's
it doing it for? Is that what you said? Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, I mean, the purpose of this is that, for example, thank you. This is great. I mean, I'll slowly go back all the way to the beginning. What it's for is that DNA is stored in a double-stranded form, and you may have discussed why that might be. I mean, it's a more stable way of storing information, and in principle, once in every cycle of copying of the DNA, you have to get it into a single-stranded form. Because you have to read the stuff that's on the inside of the base pair sequence into a messenger RNA or something, and unless you turn it out inside out like David does, under some circumstances, you have to get the information out. So basically, a helicase is built into every. For example, I mean, there are lots of examples. I'll give you some later, but this is again probably timely. There's every replication system, which is responsible for copying the other strand of, in semi-conservative replication, you end up with taking two strands of DNA, Watson and Crick, let's say, for the sake of argument, and copying them into Watson prime and Crick prime, and you end up with semi-conservative situations, so there's a new strand and an old strand tied to each one. Well, what the helicase does is expose the two strands, the surface of the two strands, so the polymerase can get at it and essentially copy it off and so forth.
But even the bubble doesn't open it up reversibly.
If there's no coupling, the bubble closes behind it again, and depending on if you can get it started properly, and then you end up on the other side and nothing's happened. But the coupling devices in the replication, of course, is the new strand that's being formed by the polymerase right behind it, and integrating this, and with the helicase in replication serves a number of very vital functions that we've been studying a lot, and that has to do with being integrated by the polymerase with the polymerase, so that in fact, and as you know, that there are two polymerases, one of which molecules at the fork, one of which copies the leading strand and moves continuously, one of which copies the lagging strand and moves discontinuously. I'm sure some of the introductory lectures covered up. All right. Let's see. I'll roll the screen up a little. All right, you roll the screen up just for a moment, because it won't take long. No, it also plays a role, for example, in transcription when it has to separate the DNA-RNA hybrid. It plays a role in RNA splicing when it takes a short sequence of RNA and puts them together and opens that up. You have an overhead. I can. We can do it any way you want. I don't care. I mean, we can put the screen up and down. Oh yeah, there's a dirty overhead. Okay, let me use that. That's simpler. Well, this one's all right. Whatever this was can be the beginning of what I'm talking about. Here's double-stranded DNA. Here's the replication fork. Here's here's the helicase in here opening up. I won't tell you everything about this because the complications are multiple and manifold since you have to couple all these things together. It's opening up the DNA and it's being driven in this direction by ATP hydrolysis. There's a polymerase behind it which makes this strand in this direction. And there's another, but since polymerase can only go in one direction, the other strand is made by a polymerase that makes it in discontinuous fragments in this direction. And then there's ligases and other things which it's primed by RNA primers, which can be then cut out again because the primers are often very poorly made in terms of sequence. And then they can be cut out again by something called ribonuclease H, which cuts only DNA RNA hybrids essentially and cleans that out. And then there's a ligase, which there's another repair polymerase that joins things together, and the ligase, and so these are called Okazaki fragments. I assure you, somebody talked about those, so this is replication. Now, anytime you DNA has to be opened and looked at, and its sequence examined under lots of conditions in repair. In recombination, in transcription, also the products of it, which are RNA, and all eukaryotes, the RNA is rearranged and pieces cut out of it before, and the helicases do all that because every time you need to expose the template surface to the light, you need to use a helicase to do that. Okay, is that cover? Yeah. Yeah, and that's one of the things that we showed some years ago, and others have showed it too. And it'll bind and move. One of the punchlines that I'll tell you about is that the separating the two strands is almost an afterthought, in the sense that you walk along one strand to which you're tightly coupled. When you hit a double-stranded piece, you push one strand off, but you replace that's thermodynamically favorable because you replace that locally with protein DNA contacts. And the question of what the ATP is used for is really turns out to be to release the hind foot so you can do it again. So to reset the system so it can recycle is what I would argue. I mean, other people will probably argue something different. Yes? I mentioned that you can have a motor proteins, for example, which will walk down tracks and without opening it. And so a motor like that, there aren't very many, to my knowledge, motors that walk along DNA and do that. But of course, you can have things sliding with a random process like lac repressor, for example, can bind non-specifically and slide along on the DNA and without opening it. Yeah, because the double-stranded DNA is a more highly charged structure than the single-stranded and so forth. Yeah.
That's a question. And a gyrase is also involved in the replication process?
Well, a gyrase and topoisomerases are involved in relaxing the getting the supercoil out of things.
What is the difference between a gyrase and a topoisomerase?
Well, they have different mechanisms, and one goes in one direction and one goes in the other. But basically, you can. I think, although. David may have a different comment. I would say that a gyrase is just a subclass of topoisomerases in a sense, and that's the easiest way to look at it.
I have a question regarding this for quite some time. Biology has no problem inventing lots of machines, but why is never invent some polymerase that goes the other way? I mean, you have to go through this.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Let's see. I've read speculations about this, and I guess they would. There are problems of them crashing into each other and things like that. And also, how do you know? I mean, they would come down supposing that you had a fork on both ends, then they would come in both directions on the same strand and knock each other off and so on. I'm just making this up. I don't know if Mother Nature was thinking such thoughts or not. Yeah.
Just one other.
Yeah.
Just separate.
Yeah.
Two of them.
Yeah, yeah. And this is actually not so difficult. I mean, it is difficult. I mean, this is called the replication trombone because you have to. Yeah, Bruce Alberts invented that, and that term, and that's in his book that some of you have read, and we wrote something about this in Science not too long ago. I mean, you can sort of think about. It's fairly easy to couple the two parts, but you also need to. Integrate the two things here. Also, there's a primase that moves along this strand and has to put. Well, of course, that's all a consequence of having the only one. Okay. Yeah, that's certainly another argument. Yeah, that you have that asymmetry within the that's a good point within the asymmetry and polarity within the backbone itself, and where phosphates are and aren't when you stop. That's a very good point. And I think you had another point or a question.
I don't know anything about
it. No, that's all right. That's. Yeah, well, that's of course something that you're absolutely right, and I'd overlook that. But of course you can do so. Proofreading is always done in the reverse direction, and in fact the polymerase has a proofreading machine built right in, as David says, and it's the same kind of proofreading I was talking about yesterday, where you misincorporate and then you have to go backwards. If you had another polymerase that went backwards anyway, then I guess that could become confused too. This at least is that's a good point, and I'd forgotten it. So anyway, those are okay. Has everybody? Shall we go ahead? Okay. So and I will show you a better slide that actually defines helicases and shows how you assay them and stuff. So as I said, they're not of much use in themselves. They're coupled to other machines, the major purpose of coupling is to trap and stabilize intermediate reaction states, and this is an important point that would otherwise be unstable. And so the coupling is sometimes built in the helicase itself, but most of the time it also prevents the thing from makes the helicase much more efficient. Often within the molecular motor, it will do much more per ATP consumed than it will when it's trying to do it all by itself and sort of slipping back all the time and things like that. So these are all issues. And to really understand helicase mechanisms, we have to think about the mechanistic basis of coupling, which clearly differ in different macromolecular machines. So it's like the general principles of a car, an internal combustion engine or whatever it is, that drives a car, and the idea that you have wheels and stuff is what I'm talking about. And then, of course, whether it's a SUV or a Lexus and how that deals with, or an electric car for that matter, and how that deals with fuel and with the road and everything else can differ from one car to another, and clearly does, and as these helicases are components. So if you pursue this car analogy to, I mean, you can say that helicase is a crucial part, like the carburetor or who knows what, and that's built into lots of machines. Whether that helicase is meant to cut grass or to drive down the road or whatever. Okay, enough. Enough analogizing. And this is actually the example that I just talked about, in fact, is a good example of functional helicase coupling, because we've been able to show that in this picture that, in fact, you can couple these two, the leading strand helicase, which is able to do strand displacement synthesis, the helicase which is able to open the DNA to permit leading strand synthesis, which is what this continuous synthesis is called. This can work all by itself, the rest of the machine isn't required to couple these two things together. And it turns out that probably what's going on here is that that this thing is chasing the helicase making this strand, and if it's quite processive, then in fact it probably runs faster than the helicase, and the rate of making this is what controls this. But under some circumstances, when you make this very non-processive and it drops off and then comes back on all the time, then you can find the limiting rate that the helicase itself can do. And sometimes the helicase, in fact, will run away from the system and make its own little bubble and move to the end while this thing then gets trapped and stuck and can't go any further. So we've been able to show that directly by putting together helicases and polymerases that aren't designed to live with each other, but then you can sort of see what the properties of a polymerase have to be to make that possible. Pardon? The reference to this, actually, it's just there's two references. There's one Fong Dong, D-O-N-G, is the first author, and I'm at the end, and it's in PNAS, and that's the original sort of ideas, the functional ideas were brought out there, and the experiment was done, and that was in PNAS in about 1996 or 7. And then just last week, we finished the actual physical chemistry of the interaction between the components and showed that they actually don't interact with each other directly at all, but everything is done through the fork. And that might be quite interesting from your perspective. And that's a very long paper with Manu Delagoutte, D-E-L-A-G-O-U-T-T-E. That just is coming out in biochemistry and has just been posted on the web, I think, because now they post them on the web as soon as the galley proofs are back. And it isn't, the journal actually hasn't appeared yet. It won't come out till April, but the thing is already fine.
It's called biochemistry.
Biochemistry, yes. This is the same journal that all those old papers of Otto Berg's that I was telling you about was in, but that was back in the 80s, and this is actually a few weeks away. but I think you'll find that useful, David, in your concerns.
Last thing you mentioned, your transcription was very slow, fast, and the draw time was about 30 milliseconds. Your replication
is faster, yeah.
Well,
one thing one speculation we've made is that it's that the replication is always thermodynamically downhill, because basically in transcription you're making a bubble and you're going forward and backward. You can go in either direction. Sometimes when you open a GC and close an AT, then in fact going forward is more difficult than going backwards and things like that. But in replication you're making two strands, both of them separately, and the two strands never peel off again. So it's sort of an irreversible process. At that level, and in addition, you have a helicase which is driven by ATP hydrolysis. So it takes several ATPs to drive. It takes an ATP to drive the helicase over, let's say, one base pair in a somewhat inefficient process. In addition, it takes an NTP to make the polymerase extend the thing one, another NTP to make the polymerase extend this one in the other direction, and so it's not so. So it's never thermodynamically reversible and therefore uphill in the forward way that transcription is. But that's only my private speculation, and there may be other reasons. But the helicase may just be more efficient or something.
How many times faster?
Well, the rate of replication is, for almost all organisms, about the dwell time is 1 millisecond at each position, while the dwell time for transcription averages more like 30 milliseconds. On the other hand, some of that has to do with pausing, which is actually built into the system for sequence-dependent reasons, and there probably isn't that kind of pausing in replication, because there's no reason really to control it at that level. And so, but those are speculations, of course. Okay, so... pardon? Right. In this, it turns out that the difficult step in doing this, and let me draw another picture. The actual development of the fork, the nucleic acid construct that what Feng Dong worked out and Steve Weitzel in our lab is one of the most difficult parts of this, although so the way this thing looks is that there's a double-stranded region, which in fact, because this goes so fast, and we weren't at that time using stop-flow reactions, we had to make this about 8,000 base pairs long, and we could and it made it in about 16 seconds or something like that. So this is 8,000 base pairs of double-stranded DNA, and then you have a fork construct. and this is leading strand synthesis on this side, so this goes in this direction. There's also a piece, a short primer put in here, and then there's another piece which, which is put behind there just to sort of make a discrete place for the polymerase to go. So the polymerase goes in here, you don't want this. The polymerase goes in here and extends this piece. Sorry, delete. this is extended here by the polymerase, and the helicase is up here, a hexamer, and the difficulty is to get the helicase to go in there, so by using macromolecular crowding, which I don't know whether you've run into or not, but this is the notion that very often, and in fact this may, whoever talks about salt dependence of histone this afternoon should bear in mind, probably will bear in mind, the notion that the inside the cytoplasm there's a very high concentration of protein all the time, and so when we do these reactions in vitro, we're working at, you know, nanomolar and at the most micromolar concentration of these components. In the cell, the things are as much as 15 or in red blood cells higher percent protein. And so there are many fewer places for a macromolecule to go. And so by you can drive association reactions by putting in other macromolecules, which will drive the reaction forward. And this has been pointed out by polyethylene glycol, which is what PEG is. It takes away a lot of places in solution. No, it's just it's completely inert as far as interacting with the. But it takes away other places in the solution. And actually, this it's an amusing thing to think about, because you think, well, okay, then I'll use sucrose instead or something like that. But if you say make the react, if you put in 7% PEG, you take away more than 90% of the sites where another macromolecule could go in solution because of the connectivity problem. You think about cells of solution, and of course PEG is a molecule which will go through many cells, and so will the many sites inside the three-dimensional cell that you're thinking about, and at the same time so will the macromolecules, so that individual sucrose atoms will just go in one cell at a time, or molecules, and so they will essentially not the fact that they're coupled together makes them much more effective as crowders, and so the solution looks like it's more than 90% occupied as far as the association is concerned. So it just drives association reactions, and it also drives oligomerization reactions that result in less asymmetric structures, and this is a whole very exciting field in itself, and Alan Minton at NIH has done a lot about this, and of course it comes from early ideas of Paul Flory and the notion that very often you find that if you take this is really a digression, you find you take tobacco mosaic virus or some kinds of very long extended rods, and you increase their concentration all the time, they'll suddenly all line up in the same direction and end up giving you linear birefringence and so on. Yeah. And all about that. Okay. The reason for that is because of the fact that they no longer fit in the solution, you know, every which way, even though of course you have entropy fighting you this way. So so macromolecular crowding is the same kind of idea. Maybe you want to put it in some other way. Sometimes one needs an interpreter. Is that okay? Okay. So or whoever asked me about PEG, I forgot. David. Yeah. So it just helps you to load. But God, as usual, provides an artificial PEG, and so there is a protein called gene 59 protein, which goes with the system, and is a loading protein, and is the artificial, it is the natural version of PEG, but this is much easier. And in this Dong paper, we use PEG to drive this loading, just because we wanted to have as few macromolecules in there as possible, or a few things that we didn't understand. That's what it's for. A long answer to a short question. So now here come the helicase definitions and terminology that you were asking for before, and so I won't spend long on it, obviously. But what a helicase does is it binds to a single-stranded region. There are some helicases which can actually pry open a double-stranded region, and REC-BCD is one of those. But most helicases require a loading site, and the loading site is single-stranded. and then there's a complementary strand to be displaced, and that I'll show you that the argument I'm making is that there's nothing, this is merely an afterthought of the helicase. The helicase just simply walks along here and displaces that as it goes. Okay? And so, I'll give you, and these are, so there are DNA helicases, where you just say the names of the two strands that are being displaced from one another. They function in replication, recombination, and repair, and other places. And you talk about the directionality along the chain, and you all know that polynucleotide chains have directionality 5 prime to 3 prime or 3 prime to 5 prime, and that has to do with the orientation of the sugar molecules in the sugar phosphate backbone, right? Any questions about that? Okay. There are also RNA-DNA helicases that work in the same way, but so the specificity is at the level of RNA or DNA. It's not at the level of the sequence usually, except for some of the RNA helicases, which actually do only very little jobs, like taking half a dozen base pairs of double-stranded RNA and moving them somewhere else in the course of the spliceosome function in getting the RNA matured that's being made in the eukaryotic nucleus to get out into the cytoplasm and function. So these are some of these things are sometimes called dead boxes, which stands for the letters of the amino acid sequence that you often find in them. But it's at least a name that you won't forget. Okay, so that's what a helicase is, and here's some examples and what they do, just very briefly, because I've already mentioned this. And there's a better table like this in the cell paper that I gave to a couple of you. So they have names. They're usually named after the genes that produce them. And so and just as physics is some ways a horror to biologists, because they have so many names of things that one has to know. Well, not as many, but biology is much more of a horror because of the fact that everything is named in a very whimsical fashion very often, and everybody forgets why the names are the way they are, and then there's three-letter things of all kinds, and so, I mean, I find it a nightmare to listen to a real cell biologist saying, you know, then the FRAF gene did blah, 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 you know, and it goes on and on like that, and you don't have any idea after a while what's going on. But So some of the issues that are interesting. So this is the E. coli replication helicase. It's a hexamer of six identical subunits. It turns out that working as hexamers of six identical subunits is a very standard thing for replication helicases in general, and that has some significance, obviously, in the details of how structurally you hold the structure open as you move along and so forth. And we've and others have. Pardon? Directionality, yes. It's defined with respect to the strand from which you load. In other words, if you if you take a helicase which is a 5 prime to 3 prime helicase like this one, and you offer it a structure which has no single-stranded end here but has one on this end, it won't do anything, because it essentially loads here depending on who you read, but the simple way to view it is that if it continues to move along the strand on which it loads, which is we can certainly show is the case in many cases, then that would be the basis of a directionality, and you can test that. In fact, another standard test is to have an opening like this in the middle of the way this some of these things were first tested was to have a here's one strand, there's a short piece here and a long piece here, and you offer it this opening in the middle, and then you ask it which way does it release this strand or does it release this strand, and you can look in a gel, and that tells you whether it's 3 prime or 5 prime, 3 prime to 5 prime or 5 prime to 3 prime, right?
Okay. You move the helicase to sort of like the barrel of a six-gun.
Yeah. No, it actually is a hexagon and some of the structures are now known, and we've done a lot of cryo-electron microscopy, and it looks like a benzene ring. I mean, you know, sort of with the big bulges around each carbon. But one of the purposes of this seems to be that's only been in some helicases. What you need to do at the level of the helicase movement itself to prevent it from reannealing as you go is to somehow keep the strands apart long enough so that the coupling factors can come along and capture the strand they want, right? Okay, and one way that that seems to be done is to open this hexameric ring and to run one of the strands through the middle of it, and the other strand along the outside. So that keeps them apart long enough for the coupling interactions to that's still something that people are sorting out in detail, but that seems to be the way one explanation for having a thing that looks like that. No, they're and most of these hexamers, in fact, and again, this comes out of lots of work in. Pardon? Oh, the table. Sorry. Yeah, most of these hexamers are, in fact, I mean, many of these things, in fact, the one that was worked on kinetically and thermodynamically for a long time, the most by Tim Lohman and his group, is a dimer, or sometimes even a monomer, but usually a dimer. And these hexamers are trimers of asymmetric dimers, in the sense that every other subunit has there's a strong they switch back and forth, but each subunit has at any particular instant of time a strong RNA binding site or a DNA binding site, single stranded, and a strong or weak ATP binding site. Three of the ATP binding sites are strong, three are weak, three of the RNA, and they probably switch back and forth as the thing moves because they're all identical subunits in terms of sequence. And so it's a reciprocating kind of a motor, and it probably works very much like the F0, F1 ATP synthase, which also has six subunits, three of which bind ATP strongly, three bind it weakly, three bind various components of ATP ATP, ADP, and empty, in that case, the Paul Boyer thing he and John Walker got the Nobel Prize for a few years ago, and the other three are. So I think all these machines have very similar behaviors, but the details are different because, of course, they have different purposes. The purpose of that one is to pump protons and make ATP, or to have proton pumping drive ATP of synthesis. And the purpose of this is to separate DNA strands. But nature finds mechanisms that work and structures that work, and then it uses them again and again. It seems as though, at least that's a generality we like to make, because nature is lazy. I mean, there's no reason to invent another way of doing things if the way you invented for something quite different already will work. And so, I mean, I'm being very terribly teleological, but you know what I'm talking about. Okay, so I won't go. This is just an example, some examples the RNA polymerase itself, core polymerase, has to move through double-stranded DNA, opening it in front, closing it behind. That's what a helicase does. So therefore, it's a helicase. So yesterday's lecture and today's helicase are today's lecture are tied together. Rho is a protein which when it's an RNA DNA helicase, I underline the strand. That's just a terminology I'm trying to get people to adopt, that the thing moves along. In this case, it moves along the RNA. But if you take a cryo-electron microscopy picture of it, it looks just like this. In fact, when my colleague who discovered the first of these then looked at this for us as well, I accused him of using the same picture twice. He said, no, one is Rho and one is gene 41 T4, and the one's a DNA replication helicase, one's a transcription factor, but they are identical, and in fact, they probably use the same trick of tucking one of the strands through the tail in order to keep it through the hole in order to keep it from coming back together again.
Is the Rho terminator
universal throughout bacteria? No, in fact, there's some genetic evidence for it, but the only one that's ever been really clearly elucidated and studied to death is the one in E. coli. There is evidence that sequence, but now that sequence is so common among other helicases, it's hard to know whether that really means that it's being used in other bacteria as well. John Richardson is doing some studies on this, but so far the convincing evidence for a Rho that really does all these things is only in E. coli. But it's a long road that Richardson started, then we sort of finished to study all that anyway, somebody would have to be pretty passionate to do it all over again on another one. And then there's the recombination helicases. This is the one that that Frank Stahl used to work on genetically, and now Steve Kolchakowski has really solved the problem of how it recognizes recombinational hotspots and switches in different ways. But its job, also as Jerry Smith and others showed long ago, it also, if you don't do anything else and disable its nuclease activity, just goes makes a bubble that moves through the DNA and then it's out the other side and nothing happens. So but this one recognizes a particular sequence called Chi, which some of you may have heard of, which is a recombinational hotspot and triggers recombination, and that seems to be a fairly universal sort of a procedure also. No, recombination is at the just simply homologous chain transfer, so that and it's a part of repair. And as we were talking about at dinner, some of us last night, it's actually the repair and recombination, and our are probably and recombinational intermediates occur in every replication cycle, because replication runs into double-stranded or single-stranded breaks quite often. And so all the wonderful ideas that biologists have had that this is God's way of reshuffling the genome and making, you know, evolution go faster, is may well be true, but it's a simple consequence of the fact that the bricks and mortar guys who are doing the recombination screw up so often that you have to do the recombination in order to avoid being irreversibly stuck. And those of you who are interested in that kind of thing and thinking about it, is Steve Kay and I edited a whole issue of TIBS, Trends in Biochemical Sciences, in February of last year, which has a whole bunch of terrific articles, including particularly the one by Steve Kay in it, that sort of put all that together. And since Tibbs insisted on sending me, I think, 50 issues of the damn thing, 50 copies. If anybody wants one, I can write me an email and I'll mail you one, at least until the pile is down. So that's in Trends in Biochemical Sciences, if you're interested in that. So you're getting a whole sort of short course here about lots of other things as yesterday, and so that's fine. Okay, so one of the questions that how are we doing here? When people need coffee, why don't you just stop me, okay? As usual, I'm about a 15th of the way through what I was going to talk about, but that's okay. One of the questions is, of course, what is the free energy of binding and hydrolysis used for, of ATP binding and hydrolysis used for in helicase reactions? It requires the consumption of ATP. It's an energy-requiring reaction. Everybody said, well, you know, it's clear that you need energy. You need to put in energy into this thing to separate the base pairs. So maybe that's what it's for, and so everybody said, well, you know, but that turns out to have some real contradictions in it, and as I'll show you, I think that in the ones that we've studied carefully, and I think many other things too, what the ATP hydrolysis is for is to release the back subunit of the helicase so that you can start the process over again, and that's very much the same idea as people are using in kinesin and things like that. And so again, I always like these mini unified field theories, that if many other systems work the same way, you can sort of think about them the same way. It's the toy models, okay, whatever. Yes, right. You need to pay for the entropy costs associated with going in one direction, and so you need it for that certainly too. And anything that, and when you don't have ATP, aren't using ATP, then you immediately disintegrate into a random walk. Right, exactly. Which could be biased structurally, but is basically a random walk. Yes. Exactly.
And of course, you have to get it back off.
That's exactly.
In fact, you have to invest in.
Yeah. Well, you're yes, and what you're saying is absolutely correct, because what I'm saying here applies to looking at a detailed model of how a helicase works. clearly the and in a sense, to get through one reaction cycle, you have to do that, and then, and so you can also say that and perfectly validly that you're paying for the opening itself. But the way you pay for the opening is indirect, I guess, and furthermore, it's quantized in a way that you can't get one full opening from one ATP molecule. So you have to think about intermediate states that you can stabilize and so forth. So I don't have any quarrel with that point. Yeah. It's just a question that people then had this idea and transferred it to saying that the mechanism has to be somehow that ATP is used to prior to and that turns out I mean, a lot of people believe that still, but I think that's something I would argue against. So what is the free energy used for? Well, this goes on. I mean, so here are some of the problems with that we just mentioned. The expected step size of the average ATP, average DNA replication helicase along its track is something on the order, if it corresponds to the size of the nucleic acid binding site of an individual helicase subunit, would be 8 to 20 nucleotides. You can only pay for, and that of course has an average base pair. If you're about 50 degrees below the melting temperature, this is a useful number to remember that Don Crothers and Bruno Zim pointed out years ago, it costs about 1 kilocalorie to open a base pair on the average. 50 degrees below the TM, of course you get closer to the TM it's less, and further away it's more. The total free energy of hydrolysis of ATP at physiological concentrations, which is about 1 millimolar, is about 10 kilocalories per mole. So therefore, you can, if you couple this directly, you can only open, you know, 10 or fewer base pairs, especially if it's inefficient. And a lot of people who were obviously not physicists, took this idea and this idea together and said, well, helicases are great, they're more than 100% efficient. And that's okay, I mean, at one level, but it can't be so. Okay? So I don't think any of you would. Well, yeah. I mean, it costs about two to three, maybe, to open it. It depends on where you are relative to TM, but it's plus or minus 50%, yeah. And so it's clear that AT base pairs fluctuate more than open, and that's been shown experimentally by lots of people. And
it's a very bumpy path.
It's a very bumpy path, just like you were talking about yesterday. Yes, exactly.
And,
well, it depends on the efficiency of coupling, and that's what I'll get to. But most of the helicases that we have looked at that work working by themselves require about one ATP to move one base pair, and that's because they slip a lot. They can probably do it, and when they're coupled, they may be able to do three or four. When they're coupled to something that keeps them from losing their place, and I'll show you a way to look at that. So possible solutions are, it takes more than one ATP but that means an incredible difficulty with coupling the free energy of both of those, and that's, I've never seen a case like that. The helicase moves in effective step sizes smaller than the binding site size, so it slips essentially, and the stabilizing of partially open intermediates is not fully effective, that's certainly true. And so the other argument is that it's not used directly, and I guess I should, instead of underlining not, I should have underlined directly to take into account your point, Don, to open the double-stranded DNA out of the helicase. Okay, so let's think about this issue of nested helicase reaction cycles. I don't know whether that's a proper word, but I made it up, I guess, but you can think of things nesting inside each other, and that's certainly, aside from bird's nest, that's also a physics term, I guess, isn't it? So the overall reaction cycle has an initiation phase, which is the loading of the helicase at the beginning of the target double-stranded DNA sequence, and you can see how this has some, you know, at least conceptual relationship to the initiation of transcription and things like that. There's the elongation phase, which is the processive translocation through the target sequence, which is a genome or a chromosome or whatever. And these helicases, when they're working properly, are totally processive. I mean, they essentially go from one end of the chromosome to the other. And because they're held on by the structure and everything else and driven by the polymerase, so it works fine. And then there's termination, where you release from the downstream end of the targeted sequence. So it's a question of whether the trapping of one or both strands of the opened lattice is completed or not. And so the helicase reaction, so this is one cycle, the helicase reaction cycle is shorter and is the cycle that you have, this is the coupled, this is the uncoupled cycle, the overall cycle, this is the reaction cycle for one using one ATPase. And I would argue that actually the initial event that has to occur before anything can happen is that the opening of the next base pair in front of the translocating helicase must be driven by fluctuations and captured as a transient opening event. And I'll show you some evidence that deals with that. So a cartoon that says the same thing, set of cartoons, and this is in the Cell paper too, looks like this. Here's an uncoupled helicase. If it can find it, if it can get onto the DNA in the first place, and it can if it's rec BCD, for example, go through and everything else requires a loading site with one side or the other protruding, goes through and comes out the other side. So this bubble moves through, and people have watched this by electron microscopy, and then it's closed again. The other thing you can do is, for example, a very simple coupling system is to use single-stranded binding protein. And you put that on, and so that I'll show you the single-stranded binding protein can't invade normally. Just a second, that essentially then stabilizes the result. So you end up with two strands that have been covered with single-stranded binding protein, and the helicase comes out the other side. Yes. Well, this is a bit of a cartoon, so I should have drawn in for the standard things to a little single-stranded protrusion there to start with. RecBCD somehow or other is able to melt its way into the beginning of the thing and then couple directionally on and follow its own strand. And so this is maybe a picture for RecBCD, but that's not a hexamer, so it's not a very good picture. But start at both ends, but it, and blunt ends, and it and works in opposite directions. And when it goes one way, it doesn't recognize chi, but in the other direction, it does recognize chi. And so it's a bit more complicated. So you're right. This picture should be drawn with a loading site.
There's some NSI in those six.
In RecBCD, there are actually only three components. It's a trimer of three different kinds of subunits. Yeah, but that's not true of everything. I mean, in other words, there are quite a few more helicases and other things than replication and this transcription helicase of Rho, where that other strand, there's another solution done to capturing keeping the two strands separated, and you know that we in many cases we don't. Yeah, it has the binding sites on the subunits are polar, and so is the chain. So if it fluctuates open, and is presented with the choice between these two binding sites, it will always choose this site, because this is the one that points in this direction and matches the polarity of the binding site. All these single-stranded binding proteins also bind in a polar fashion. I didn't say that, but that. A lot of us had to do experiments to prove that in the early days too, and it moves. So it moves down in one direction, and it can. But RecBCD normally also acts as a nuclease and chops the thing up as it moves, and chops one strand more than the other. So it's a much more complicated story that could occupy 2 hours just by itself. But so
if.
Yes.
Because there is 3' on one side and 5' on the other side.
Sure, 3', 5', 5', 3', yeah.
It must be that the directionality is induced by whatever happens initially, which might be random.
No. There's not symmetry in the way it's bound in there. It's bound to.
That's the point, that the asymmetry is only in the machine and not in the DNA.
Absolutely. Yeah, but the asymmetry is in the machine, because the machine can tell 3' from 5' directionality, right? 5', 3' from 3', 5'. Because the binding sites are polar. So you can say that, well, why isn't it coupled? It isn't coupled in the same way to these other guys. And furthermore, every other one has a strong and a weak binding site. This has been a. And so you think about it as the probability of releasing in one direction relative to the other. And Oh boy, I better not go into it, but I can give you a reference to where, in a paper with Hans Geiselman, where we made a detailed model of that for Rho, which is in, Geiselman is the first author, G-E-I-S-E-L-M-A-N-N, and that's in PNAS in 1993, as I recall. Gee, I'm impressing myself that I can remember all these things still, but at least the right year. Yeah.
You just said without ATP, it would just slide randomly.
Without ATP, it would slide randomly, right. Well, the machine, yeah, probably wouldn't rotate, and actually, I don't know whether there's much evidence that these things without ATP will, if you trap the in the middle of a bubble, it'll. I mean, most things will slide randomly, so I would guess it would, but I don't really know an experiment that's been shown directly for a helicase. I mean, we've showed it for that kind of a helicase. We've certainly showed it for transcription complexes, which are sort of helicases in the way I'm defining them. Yeah.
So it's hard to see how important double strand is. If you have single strand, does it move faster?
Well, that's an interesting point. It turns out, and there's another punchline later on, but let me say it now. It turns out that when you translocate Rho along single strands, it moves at a slightly about the same rate if the single strand is really stretched out, and furthermore, it takes just as much ATP hydrolysis to move one step on the single strand as it does to move through the double-stranded region. And in fact, when you then raise the salt concentration, so the single strand gets a little more difficult, it gets secondary structure in it and a little more difficult to handle. Then, in fact, it moves more slowly on the single-stranded region because it has to force it; it has to lay it out properly. While essentially, you can say the role of the other strand and the double-stranded region is actually to keep the keep it laid out properly so that it can take advantage of it. And we found this result very startling, that the same amount of ATP, and this is really gets at this issue that people have been talking about what the ATP is used for, the same amount of ATP is used in when you're going through the regions that are double-stranded as when you're going along the single-stranded per step advanced. And arguing again that it's advancing along the single strand, which is critical, and pushing the and then releasing afterwards, and that of course happens under all those circumstances. I mean, it at least fits everything together. You know, am I making it clear?
How do you get the income balance?
How do you get what?
The money. How do you get money balance?
How do you? Yeah, but you see, you as you make the intermediate states, you end up getting the thermodynamic, the free energy out of making a protein DNA hybrid. It's not a hybrid, a protein DNA complex, which is more stable very often, or just as stable as the base pairs that you've opened. And very often when you end up with a coupled system, you've replaced things permanently with other proteins, so that therefore you get your money in that sense. And the only step that's really unfavorable is picking up your back foot, because then you don't have anything to that release process and moving it forward, just as in the movement of...
In the single strand case, more energy are dissipated as vapor.
No, because it's the same process in both cases. In one case, you're just pushing a strand aside, and the other case. So yeah, what you're saying is that on the average, since you didn't have to pay that somehow or other, you maybe have a bit more heat in the solution or something. But it was a very very interesting result that I didn't expect at all, that it would cost the same amount of ATP to advance the same distance. And that's only, of course, been shown in one system so far. That's Rho, which is one that we were able to separate all the component, that the parts of the loading from the transcript from the movement from the helicase that's general. I would guess it would be generally true, but I'm generalizing from one case. Yeah.
If it's recessing normally, why doesn't it spiral around with the pitch of the helix?
Why doesn't it turn with the? Well, we don't know that it doesn't. I mean, it pardon?
It probably does.
It probably does. I don't see any reason not to. I mean, it depends again on whether the whole machine in which the helicase is held to a membrane or something, and it's shoving the DNA through it, or whether the DNA is held somewhere. And very many of the model experiments, like the ones that David over there does, the helicase, it's the DNA that's nailed down, and then it has to then the thing presumably spirals around. Yeah, yeah. In fact, there was a very nice. Mickey Schur, I think years ago, after we did some of this stuff with lac repressor, showed that that it was reasonable to think, in fact, that the track of lac repressor, when it was sliding along DNA, might be, because it's essentially sitting on these monorails of charge and sliding along them. Yeah, yeah.
In the supreme being here, compared to top and the bottom, which has the lower
degree? Well, probably the bottom one is more favorable because otherwise it wouldn't happen. Yes, absolutely. The helicase is always a catalyst. A catalyst that uses ATP to exactly. And of course, which of these is more favorable depends upon the concentration of protein in solution. And in fact, so you can take all these reactions and you can make them either be thermodynamically uphill or downhill, depending on whether you increase or decrease the concentration of the binding ligand, right? Okay? Okay. Yes. Well, it's downhill because you put so much protein in that it is thermodynamically downhill. In the limit where you have, sometimes if you have a mutant that produces very little gene 32 protein, then you can fix things so it becomes uphill and then it's slower and it slows down replication and ask Gary Stormo about that because he and Larry Gold and their colleagues worked out a lot of those details back. 25 years ago, I guess now.
Something that produces a single strand binding protein right in the vicinity of this.
The case that Gary and Larry and I and all of my students and postdocs worked on was the single stranded binding protein of T4, and we were able to work out a model, which is still almost my favorite paper, still the one from 82, where we actually were able to model the whole system by showing that, because what Larry and his colleagues had showed before was that that gene 32 autoregulates its own synthesis, and the way we were able to put all this together was the notion that it binds first to the fork, it binds better to DNA than to RNA, then it binds to the RNA, which contains an open region, an unstructured region, which makes that site the which they call the translational operator, which is the thing that binds to ribosomes, and then when the concentration of stuff free in solution gets down, then it falls off that thing, it turns on the synthesis machine again. So I always say it's very much like the flush toilet, you know, when the water comes up, it turns the water, but it raises the bulb and turns it off, and so you can, that's not a very elegant way of putting it, but yeah.
Has anyone ever measured the sequence dependence of the binding affinity?
Yeah, we measured all that, and it turns out, I think we were talking about this yesterday, it turns out on the average to be compositionally averaged, so that unless there are long blocks of something, and the long block that's the most problematical is long blocks of T, to which it binds much more tightly, and from which salt displaces it. But in this paper in the Journal of Molecular Biology in 1982, we went through and got all these tables together and showed that you could actually, on the average, estimate the binding to any particular sequence as the sum of the compositional components of A, T, G, and C binding.
And the number of base pairs, the typical one of these things covers
up? It covers seven. And the site on the unusual site, and of course you can see that if you have a bunch of different RNAs where a single-stranded binding site is terminated by, say, two very stable hairpins or something, then the longest one would be bound to first, because you have both the binding constant itself at every level, and then you have the cooperativity parameter, which we called omega. And so if you, for example, bind to a site that, say, holds seven or eight of these things, then you would get, say, eight Ks and seven omegas or something. Well, if you bind to a smaller hole, you'd have three Ks and two omegas or something, and that would be less stable. So that was the original basis on which we thought this all worked. And then there's a little more subtlety to it, as Larry's lab with McFeeters in particular showed later. There's also a pseudo knot at the end at one end of this thing, which turns out also to bind gene 32 particularly well, so it nucleates from that end, and so that was a refinement in another beautiful paper that I had the pleasure of editing for JMB, which from Larry's lab, which added that last nail to the coffin, or sort of nails. Well, it's not a coffin; it's an opening. Okay, so finally. finally, here we are with the thing advances a certain distance, p or p 1, 2, 3 or whatever it is, through the sequence for every ATP that's hydrolyzed, and that could be one or several base pairs, and what it needs ahead of itself to do that is a fraying open of the base pairs, and a single base pair, as Don Crothers and others measured years ago, frays open at the end of a double helical DNA in less than a microsecond. So that's usually not the rate limiting step for the movement of a replication system, which moves, of course, one step per millisecond. So that you can use that as but to fray open a whole bunch of different of these at the same time, so a coupling protein can like that can bind fully, is very unlikely, and therefore this thing, as I told several of you in private conversations yesterday, a single stranded binding protein could be a rogue helicase running away with things, because it could melt everything because it's thermodynamically downhill to do so, but it's kinetically blocked from doing so in a way that I'll show you in a minute. So we need coffee? I think we need coffee. Okay, so we'll start up again. And I really enjoy this. So we shouldn't feel. And I'm trying not to feel guilty that I'm not going to ever tell you a full story. But whatever part of the story is fun, you can hear. Well, I'm trying to tell the most interesting stories, but trying to tell it sequentially. Okay. So the next general mechanistic questions relate are, how general are helicase mechanisms, and are there common structural elements involved? And I've already convinced you, I think, that at least at the level of hexamers and stuff, it's very general, and there are lots of very similar structural elements. And then I want to sort of play these two points off against each other in the next little few minutes, and that is, first ask, are there simpler proteins that use ATP hydrolysis to drive a related reaction that doesn't involve base pair opening? And that'll be Gary's and my favorite protein, gene 32 protein, as an example of that, under some circumstances. So that's a conditional yes. Are there simpler protein and protein models that can perform the helicase function without hydrolysis of ATP? And that's this one. And the other one is kinesins and stuff like that, right? Okay. So what are the functional requirements for a helicase? And again, a lot of these things I can go through fast because we've already talked about them. Helicase move directionally along the single-stranded and nucleic acid strand on which they load, displacing the complementary nucleic acid strand as they move. They carry a cryptic ATPase activity that's specifically activated by binding the nucleic acid cofactor, or the TRAC, in other words. So this ATPase activity isn't even turned on unless they're bound to a TRAC, or if it's turned on at all, it's turned on very weakly. And then the helicases are oligomeric proteins with more than one nucleic acid binding head domain or subunit or foot. And at least one of these has to be bound at all times to permit processive translocation, because otherwise you lose your place, essentially, and you slide away. And so a lot of the arguments that monomeric helicases can be monomers, they can be, but they're very inefficient because they have a sort of a biased random walk rather than actually walking very efficiently. So, a simpler protein that resembles helicases in moving directionally, but along specific tracks driven by ATP hydrolysis, but they do not separate the tracks. Of course, that's half of what helicase does. And so kinesins, motor proteins hydrolyze ATP and go directionally, and their models, the model that everybody believes now is the Hackney model, that's very similar to this Geiselman et al. Model we did over here for Rowe and stuff. But it's called the hand-over-hand, tightrope walking model. There's another model that people talk about for a while, which I only put on here because the fighting ducks are the symbol of the University of Oregon, and there's the waddling model where it goes along two strands like this, sort of. And, but forget about that. That was just for fun. The hand-over-hand, tightrope walking model is what applies. But it's useful to think about this as a reaction cycle. So here's a dimeric walking motor protein, kinesin, for example. And this is the free energy of activation barriers it has to go over. So here's one head bound. Put the other foot down, and that's actually favorable because now you got 2 feet bound. So this is okay. But then you have to release the back foot to put it forward again, and that is uphill. And so this is where ATP hydrolysis comes in. And in fact, it's the releasing of the back foot and then swinging it around to the front and positioning it that requires ATP. Then the second one binds again spontaneously and two heads are bound. And so you go from one head bound, two heads bound, downhill, fight your way back to putting one free again. And so this is the same thing that a helicase has to do, but at the same time it has to do this by opening the track. And I would maintain that it does it very much in the same way, and I'll show you in a minute. So any questions about this? What's that? Oh, just to tell you, separate one foot so you can see which foot is which. So the black foot, they switch halfway, right? Yeah. So I mean, of course, they're the same, and the cycle starts over again. And now, at the end, it'll come back to that again and so forth, right? So it's just to discriminate between. Did I miss up the colors? Let's see. The black foot gets in front. Yeah, it's okay, I think. Yeah. Oh, you mean how do they differ in terms of ATP binding and stuff? Yes, I see what you mean. Yeah, they differ in the being in different stages of their individual ATP cycles, I suppose, right?
So what happens is that the ATP bound on the left, as it enters the cycle,
yeah,
hydrolyzes, therefore left becomes white, and then ATP binds to the next one.
Well, no, this can be. What's that?
Does it physically swing
or? Yes, that's what people think it does. And in fact, it has to.
Then that's a waltz model.
That's a what?
They're dancing.
Well, waltz, yeah. Walking is good enough. I mean, that's what you do with your back foot, right? You physically swing it past your front foot, and you have to aim it right so it doesn't end up, crossing your legs or something like that, right?
And it's known what unit.
It's walking along tubulin, and there are discrete binding sites, which are 8 nanometers apart, or 16, which is it, I've forgotten, 8, I think. And so it binds to those discrete sites without slippage, and this is a very tightly coupled reaction when it's working with the dimer. But you can show that with a monomer, you have some tendency to slide forward, but then it becomes a random walk. Jeff Gellis and other people did a very nice job of that. You can get mutants which won't dimerize, and then essentially you can just do one-footed reactions, and they are not discrete and tightly coupled. And in fact, they have another word for tight coupling, high-duty cycle and low-duty cycle. I guess that's a...
One-footed
Tennyson tends to go forward, maybe because it has some polarity to it, but it sort of just drags itself along, and it does a random walk, and you can actually see it doing a random walk. And Jeff had done some very nice, and others too have done very nice.
For a healthy one, the stride length is 8 nanometers.
Right. Yeah.
What is the
actual movement? How long? How far is it? Here, for example, this picks up and moves forward. So this would be where the...
Is it actually the stroke of movement?
Yeah, you could say that, yeah.
What we're seeing is that when we look at the two steps that are defined by the ATP reaction,
mm-hmm.
then the white...
The white foot comes from behind and now is ahead.
Because in a particular position of the frame,
yeah.
The white is at the same position.
Yeah, but the black has now sat down, which gives you two heads bound as at least an intermediate.
Bound twice in this scheme.
No.
Different,
because they are one step apart. Right. Well, I mean, I'm artificially breaking this into a pair and saying first one, and something active may happen here too. It's just, this is just a very oversimplified scheme. Right. Yeah. And this is one, by the way, Terry, that can't slide because there are specific binding sites which should be shown by a little discontinuities that it can only bind in those specific places, right? Unless under certain circumstances, there's only 1 foot, and then it, yeah. Well, so I shouldn't have said that so dogmatically. It can slide if it only has 1 foot down, but can't when it has 2 feet down, because they, at least not much, because they, this is very efficiently coupled under those circumstances. Yeah, so let me back off from being too dogmatic about that. Okay, so that's that. And now this is the other half of the story. Can a single-stranded binding protein, which doesn't work, have ATP, and therefore, of course, can't be directional? Can it work as a thermally driven helicase? The answer is generally no, not for thermodynamic, but for kinetic reasons. And this is this old story that Gary was involved in, and Larry and Gold and so forth, and a lot of people in my lab. So this is the T4-coded gene 32 protein. The size of the single-stranded DNA nucleic acid binding site is 7 nucleotides, and it has to bind 7 nucleotides at a time to move. So the question is, so this is just a piece of DNA which is double-stranded. Here's excess gene 32 protein in solution. So to make it thermodynamically downhill, the black, heavy black parts are coated with 32 already. We did the experiments like this because some of which we never published because they just proved what we already knew. But I'll show you a couple more pictures of them. The central double-stranded DNA is, even when you've got it in this position, which is about as favorable as it could be for going forward, is kinetically blocked from melting as the free gene 32 protein concentration is raised, even though the melted single-stranded and coated form is thermodynamically stable. And I'll show you for in a minute that there's one particular form of double-stranded DNA that this can invade, and I'll show you why I think that is. Okay, so let me just go.
Kinetically blocked is because of the small probability.
Probability of opening 7 at once, right? And this is just actually stolen from this paper that Gary and I and others were involved in. But basically, it just shows you, on one side the net free energy is the sum of the binding free energy and the conformation you have to overcome. It's the same ideas as before. And so here are a couple of here's a hairpin model where you have this, and you can, if you can open all this, then you can melt this, then you put this in there, and this is the thermodynamically favored state here, like this also, in the presence of excess this. But you have to actually do the melting, get above the melting temperature or close to it to make this happen. Because those are the ones, just to show you which ones were already there and which ones we added afterwards. They're all the same protein.
Now, if that double-stranded region, if it's a polynomial sequence?
If you stay below the melting temperature, even though you're above the melting temperature thermodynamically because you've got so much single-stranded binding protein in, it just stays that way. But if it's palindromic, I'll show you another picture in a minute that shows you what happens then. Okay, so here's, in fact, where we really labored mightily to demonstrate this. Here's Mark Young and John Newport both did a lot of this. Here's a structure where we put single-stranded binding protein on two over single-stranded overhanging ends here, and this was kinetically blocked. Notice the X, exonuclease 3 treated lattice, so you have this thing whittled and you have nice single-stranded binding sites, but you can't get there even though you have an excess of 32. Here we made a bubble in the AT-rich DNA in lambda, and the lambda DNA, where there's AT rich, we lined that with gene 32 protein and even put some formaldehyde in it too, a little bit, just enough to stabilize this, and then showed that you still couldn't get to this state because you couldn't, from that bubble either, drive this open. But on the other hand, if you take a very simple melting protein, and that's the first one we ever studied, and that's formaldehyde. Formaldehyde is a single-stranded binding protein model, which Jim McGee and I studied years ago and very exhaustively. This thing can, in fact, melt DNA to equilibrium, but note that formaldehyde attacks on the amino or imino groups of the base, and it has to attack perpendicular to the plane of the bases, so it requires an unstacked and an open base pair to attack. So it has to breathe open. And this thing can go to equilibrium. It's not thermodynamically blocked, kinetically blocked, sorry. So the question is, what's the difference between gene 32 protein and Terry's already told us that what it is, but a non-directional helicase? The answer, 32 has a binding site size of 7. This has a binding site size of 1. We fray these kinds of things in a microsecond, but seven at a time is almost impossible. The melting depends on thermal fraying. The probability of a single base pair opening then being captured in a reasonable length of time is greater than one per microsecond. Low free energy of activation barrier, the probability of seven is high. And how is the kinetic block overcome on these palindromic ones? I'll show you. Yes? It covers seven exposed bases and then binds cooperatively. So it binds with a 10 to the third higher binding constant when it's binding next to one that's already there than otherwise. No, it actually binds with the backbone mostly. In fact, that's why it's fairly sequence independent. So as long as it can stretch out the backbone, because the end result is that its physiological purpose is to put the replication fork in the right structure for the polymerase, and so what it does is stretches the base pairs out and stretches out the bases, and in fact the length of each nucleotide when it's bound to gene 32 protein is 7 angstroms, which is about double, of course, what it is when it's partly stacked and stuff. And so they really are laid out, you know, nailed to the cross, if you like, or however. But it does it mostly from the side that doesn't have the base pairs, because the base pairs are still available in some cases to react with other things, like the polymerase as a template. Okay. So here's this thing as a cartoon, again with an activation barrier. So here's the reaction. We're trying to put the next single-stranded binding protein in, and I just made this 5 nucleotides long to make it a little less tedious to draw the picture, but it would be 7 for gene 32 protein and something different for others. So here's the barrier you have to get over in one. It would be 8 KTs, essentially, to get 5 of those exposed at the same time. Very unlikely. But if you can trap sequential things, then the reaction will, of course, go very rapidly, because each of these is only about a KT and a half, which is certainly accessible. And in answer to the question Terry was asking, here it just says move through one base pair at a time, again driven by thermally induced single base pair movement, moves directionally as long as coupled to transcript synthesis or something like that, moves randomly if decoupled. Wait a minute, I got this in the wrong place. Sorry, I wanted to show you this first, and then that. So this is the point that what does we talked about this a little bit at the break with some of you over here. Here's all the only DNA that can be melted to equilibrium is alternating DADT, I mean the only simple one. The way it works is that when you get close to the melting temperature, you have the possibility of forming palindromic structures. And these palindromic structures are big enough so that even in this state, you never open 7 at a time. In this state, you open the equivalent of 7 at a time, this is my speculation at least, and our speculation, that you can get the next one in there, because this makes a hole that's bigger than this. And as we were talking about before, I mean, you know, triplet expansion diseases and things like that can have some relationship to these kinds of things. So Bruce Alberts first showed that this particular thing can be melted to equilibrium, nothing else can, and that was sort of and I think this is the reason for it, that you have.
Is it because that in equilibrium when you make the AT sequence, they already track some of the conformations trapped in this
state? I think at very low temperatures, far below the TM, you have very little of this. And in fact, then the reaction goes very slowly. But as you get near the TM, which of course is partly controlled also by the concentration of the 32 protein, then you have a significant concentration of these kind of fluctuations, which can then be grabbed. So it's just an extension of my argument that nature is always grabbing fluctuations rather than prying things open with a crowbar and stuff like that. You know.
If you get close to TM, then even other non-palindromes.
No, they can't form those palindromes because you have to have a.
Yeah, suppose this is.
No, but even very close to TM, the probability of releasing, fraying 7 open from the end is so small that it doesn't happen. I mean, so in fact, these experiments that we did to try to push that as far as we could were conducted just below TM. Still didn't work. So these things are kinetically blocked and prevented from becoming rogue helicases, if you want to look at it that way. And in fact, let me just say one other thing, and that is that we can, which isn't on the slide, but you can take these gene 32. So the question is, how unlikely is it to be able to open, to have a flexible binding site that can sort of trap intermediates? And one way you can do that, it turns out, is that if you cut the end off gene 32 protein, which turns out now from the structures to be a flap that sort of covers the binding site, then in fact it is more flexible and able to roll in one at a time. And then this GP32 star, which still has the binding site but has the flap removed, can now in fact invade regular DNA. So you're back, because it can do it one at a time, probably. And I'll show you, and so that's probably what a helicase does. And it may be that rather than a helicase being very special and being able to do that, you can say that these melting these single-stranded binding proteins are very special in being able not to do that, because you want to prevent that, presumably. I mean, nature wants to prevent that. Yes?
Sir, I have a question. The notation little
dc and little da stands for... Oh, God. This part, it's crazy. I mean, it goes crazy over here. So an A and a T are always hydrogen bonded to each other. I don't know...
It's
deoxy, yeah, and but the T, that's wrong. I don't know. I never looked at this before, but good Lord, I hope that's not published in Cell, but it maybe I'll be. Oh God.
And a single binding protein is unidirectional.
A single binding protein is directional in the sense that it binds preferably in one direction relative to the other.
So it's really as you open up.
That's the only way it can be cooperative, because they're all heading in the same direction.
One strand is advancing, and the other strand is sort of tagging along. When it opens, I'm not thinking that something.
Yeah, I mean, basically you're binding, and then you bind one in reverse on the other strand. It can bind both strands, but in one case, I mean, so it's not advancing. You don't want to look at it advancing. It's just that it can flop in and with the right orientation. Yeah, but the orientation has to be the same way along the same strand, because it binds cooperatively, and that cooperativity requires head to tail binding. Yeah, I don't know what the hell happened there. I guess
it's a French.
Well, more than that, worse than that. I'll have to look at that paper and see if I did that. Oh well, I guess people will understand what I'm talking about. Yeah. Yeah, because your two hands are incorrect. Of course, you have to do it like this, right? I mean, that's not exactly right either. But they all the thumbs should be on the same side.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That's right. So there's an omega factor which puts the two together and this is the free energy of taking two that are oriented properly and moving them together on the same chain. That's what omega is. It's a free energy which is and for a non-cooperatively binding protein that's unity, so it doesn't help. But for a cooperatively binding protein, it's 10 to the third, let's say, in this case. No, the omega is the same, but they all bind in the same way. I mean, this omega is the same as this omega.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but the thumb has to be on the same side in both cases. Yeah, okay. Yeah, and did you have a question, David? If you can't form cruciform forms, and then you can get the single binded. Yeah.
Why can you then not
help the
single?
Well, you can. If you go above the melting temperature, then in fact you're stable, and then you can lower. So it's a hysteresis phenomenon. Yeah, it's possible just below the melting temperature to form the cruciforms, because in fact that's been shown by spectroscopy that you can begin to get things which haven't quite got the same spectra here and CD and other things. And at that point you can put in the single-stranded binding protein, and if you're above the melting temperature as far as the thermodynamically final state would be concerned, you stay there. If you're below the melting temperature for some reason, because you don't have very much single-stranded binding protein, it might be extruded again. But it's thermodynamically sensible. I mean, what I'm trying to say, even if I'm not why don't you form crucible forms way down below the melting?
Why do you need to form crucible forms near the melting temperature if it's not using the most?
Why do you form crucible forms? Because this. I'm sorry. You make a big hole here that's big enough to put seven in.
How do you get to this melting temperature? Do you start from very below the increased temperature? Yeah. Or do you start from above?
Start from below.
From below.
Yeah. Why not? But you can start from above too if it's thermodynamic. I mean, but then you can't drive the proteins out again. Is accessible?
Yeah.
Why is it accessible?
Yeah.
Why not? Because you have a bigger hole. See, the reason why you don't form these cruciforms far below the melting temperature is that the difference in there's still extra base pairs opened here relative to here, and but not seven. But it looks like it could be seven or something equivalent to seven. I'm speculating there. I mean, we don't know the detailed structure of this, but it could be as much as seven, you know. And by the time you come around in this direction and go up this way and then down this way and so forth, or maybe you can get three or four here and then the whole thing rolls over a little and you get the other three or four. I mean, you know, in other words, a very stiff. The observation is that a very stiff binding site of this sort can operate on this thing, and I'm not trying to weasel out of this. I'm not sure that I'm answering your questions. Well, maybe you can interpret, Gary.
I think I understand. Maybe I have a new question. But the point is that in order to make a stable cruciform like that, so the loop has to be at least 3 nucleotides long. That's fine.
Yeah.
To make a stable hairpin, you have to have at least two steps. So that's 7 base pairs.
Yeah.
In order to make a cruciform, you had to have melted at least 7 base pairs. A bubble in the middle.
Yeah.
Or for the form.
Yeah.
And you melted 7 base pairs. Why is that more stable than just melting 7 base pairs in between two? Why is the cruciform more important than intermediate? In either case, you had to have melted at least 7 base pairs to get.
Yeah, but this isn't seven. Oh, I see. I get you. Okay, why do these cruciforms form at all? If a fluctuation to expose 7 base pairs is unreasonable, because basically there's some entropy involved in making these things instead of this thing, and furthermore, I mean what I'm thinking of as a mechanism is that maybe there's only 3 here. But if you put that one half of a gene 32 protein in and then it waits, then this thing can roll away and expose 3 or 4 more.
But I think the question is, in order to get to that form,
no?
You have to transiently melt open at least 7 base pairs.
Right, no, but somehow or other being able to form palindromes seems to favor that a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's because you don't have to form the cruciform at once.
Yeah, yeah, and the cruciform can be formed, right? Okay, it can roll in and out, you know, once you start it, and so maybe to start a cruciform doesn't require the opening of 7 base pairs. Maybe that's the answer to what David's asking about.
We're talking about thermodynamics here.
Yeah.
One may be slightly less stable than the other.
Yep.
We can only
get
the temperature is high enough.
Yeah.
We will get a distribution.
Yeah.
We don't have to rationalize it in terms of base by base.
Well, you do, because I was trying to use that same argument to say that you don't.
It is a lower barrier.
Yeah, it's a lower barrier. It has to be a lower barrier. And you can, and what I'm saying is that we can also lower the barrier by essentially cutting the end off this thing to make it more able to take advantage of one at a time. I'm sure that most of you aren't satisfied still, but I hate to duck behind thermodynamics in that particular sense, because after all, we're interested in mechanism, and so you can say, you know, this is a stable state relative to this, but we don't care how we get there. I do care, and that's.
At the point, not every sequence will form.
Every sequence will not, except for this one, and maybe some of these Huntington disease things and so on.
Base sequence, then you, will form it, and
Although the rate at which it forms can be very variable. Some of them form very slowly, some of them form very rapidly, and this is something we don't understand, a place for a physicist to work, to try to figure out, since Terry always wanted me to point out places that physicists can work.
No, when you change this, change the single term binding point, it's going one at a time. So presumably one of the strands will shift in one base.
Yeah.
Right. But then you're still leaving one base at the end exposed, and you have to move seven bases before that gets covered. So it seems like you're still leaving seven.
Yeah. We probably. I mean, this is. You know, I mean, I don't think it necessarily it leaves seven base pairs exposed. I mean, in other words, yes. So we open this, and one partly binds in here, and then maybe it has to shift. I mean, some studies have been made of the kinetics of this, especially by Tim Lohman and Steve Kolchakowski, and these things slide along the DNA as clusters because again they don't bind, and okay. Yeah. So they're sliding, and you know, you can get there. Yeah. So.
Well, if that's the case, then why do you have to?
Well, because apparently the site isn't exposed on the single-stranded DNA binding protein until the cover hasn't been taken off, until all six or seven of them can bind, because that's another equilibrium that's involved here, and that's why when you cut the cover off, then it becomes more like a helicase. And so what I was trying to say before is that single-stranded binding proteins that are involved in replication may be designed to prevent that, essentially, because you don't want them to be helicases at points where they, because otherwise they would open all the DNA and then you'd be stuck, long before the polymerase came along. Teleology eventually leads in circles, but okay. Okay. We've already gotten to noon. Let's. What would you like me to do? Stop? I can stop certainly. Pardon? All right. But anybody who wants to go, feel free to do so. I'll just as I've said yesterday, talking is a lot easier than listening. So you guys are the ones who are suffering. So, okay. So the transcription complex, I already showed you how it slides around. So maybe I don't even have to do that. I'll skip over all that business because the transcription complex is a helicase. Remember, I showed you something that looked like this. This is from another paper, but basically this is this business that once you unpin the nucleotide triphosphate here, then the nucleic acid framework can slide relative to the polymerase. So this is actually the kind of sliding that random sliding, or when it's coupled, then it's a very unidirectional helicase. And we talked about that yesterday, right? It's the same picture only with a few more words on it. Okay. And here's rho protein. I showed you this picture too, binding to its unstructured binding site, translocating up here, and then opening the hybrid. And we were, Katie Wallstrom and our lab was able to make a really nice model system out of this. Here's rho protein binding to its unstructured binding site. And now instead of having the having the whole, the DNA strand or the other strand right all up to here, there's this long stretch of RNA before it gets there, and we could watch it walking on this region without displacing DNA, and then walking on this region with displacing DNA, and we'd made a shouldering aside model essentially that was this Geiselman paper in the 93 PNAS that I told you about already of how that works, and that seems to be holding up pretty well. So that this is the studies from Katie's work in 1998 and thereabouts. So it binds at the unstructured site, moves along the RNA strand with full processivity. If you go to higher salt, then you begin to form secondary structure here, and then it has trouble moving through all that. But at the low salt, it can get all the way up here without any loss at all. Then it can displace the strand, and the rate of ATP hydrolysis is the same whether the helicase is translocating along the single-stranded RNA through the hybrid, or in fact is stuck and sort of spinning its wheels on the end. It's releasing and binding and releasing and binding, and it tosses the same ATP per unit moved along here, for example, whether or not you're displacing the strand. And there are a bunch of, fortunately I told you most of this in words as an answer to various questions. So here is a bunch of different ones where there's short pieces, longer pieces, pieces with a fork, etc., etc. All of them can be displaced to one point, and this shows that within the limits of error, they all get ATP hydrolysis per displacement is the same for all of them. And I won't bother you with the details unless somebody wants to see that in detail afterwards. So translocation is fully processive. It's a loosely coupled helicase with an apparent efficiency, actually, of one or two ATPs hydrolyzed per nucleotide triphosphate translocated, but I think that's because it slips a lot in doing it. And let's not go into all the asymmetry issues again, which are complicated. Let me just see if I can get us to the end. There's a lot of work on chaperones and things, which I find a nice, as well as work that we've done on Roe, but this is a nice sort of thing to show that ATP hydrolysis can drive a conformational change that leads to the release of a bound ligand. In this case, this is the Sigler and Arthur Horwich work on these chaperonin complexes. They have hydrophobic groups exposed inside the chamber, which binds the unfolded protein, the hydrophobic groups of the unfolded protein. Then they essentially massage this thing by having a conformational change that rolls those hydrophobic residues inside the wall and puts hydrophilic residues there instead. That releases the RNA, the protein, so it can then fold. And Walter Englander, who was my first postdoc actually, and a lovely fellow, and his colleagues showed that this results, by hydrogen exchange techniques, that this results in the folding of the protein when it's released, because it's released from the wall and can fold up. And so here's a case where ATP hydrolysis is used to drive release, and I've been arguing all the way through that ATP hydrolysis is used to drive release. And let me leap to the end and just show you this cartoon, which is very much like the cartoon I showed before. Now we have a flexible sort of a helicase head, and so if you can collect the intervening, capture and accumulate the intervening single-stranded nucleotides by the leading subunit, then you essentially roll your way in one step at a time without costing anything but binding energy, and it's only when you release the black back foot that you need to pay with ATP, right? So this is a unifying hypothesis for a lot of things that many of you probably have thought of too, but it does pull things together. And here's a picture of the asymmetric hexamer sort of maybe rolling in some similar way, but of course no details because the structure isn't known yet. So I think that's a good place to stop. I mean, there's a lot of other overheads, but I think you've suffered enough. So let me stop there, and we can talk privately, and there'll be a session this afternoon where you want to discuss single-stranded, non-specific and specific binding, and I'd be glad to help discuss that if it comes. So, okay. Thank you.